Whoever wants to learn a word in Finnish.
No.
Right? Whoever wants to learn how to say no in Finnish. Finnish is the like weirdest language. Like there's like a thousand letters. Look, this guy's already offended. He's just like, fuck it. This isn't the Finnish language, apparently. All right, so everybody... wait, I gotta record this. I'll teach you all how to say no in Finnish.
It's not yes,
that's a good. That's a trick question. Yes. You almost got me. You almost got me.
Yes is a different word.
Okay.
It's actually a series of words.
Okay. So this is what I game with Toby Mahanen. He's Skjort on RPGNet, if any of you know him, and he's a Finn. And ready? So this is how you say no in Finnish. You say no. So wait. So can you guys do that? Can you say no for Toby?
Yeah. Ready? So one, on three. So one, two, three, no, and finish. Go.
No.
That's really good.
And now he's going to the train.
It was like you're a thousand Tokis in the room.
Now, should you teach him how to say yes?
Oh, sorry. Right,
yes is more advanced.
Yes is harder. Yes has multiple syllables.
So, okay. So wait, I'll teach you. So yes is, so ready? Ja, hehe.
Yeah,
and you gotta say hey, like you're a pederast or something.
That's true. Right?
Yeah.
So yeah,
beat.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Right. It's not yeah. It's yeah. Because you've thought about it. You said yes. You've thought about it, and you said yes. I'm a Finnish pederast. Right, ready? So all right, on three. How do you say yes in Finnish? One, two, three.
Yeah.
Okay. I love that.
Perhaps the best audience we've ever had. Okay, we have a technical request. Since Gen Con likes to keep it real and teach seminars back in like 1978, when we were all like four, or I'm dating myself, and does not like to give us any kind of audiovisual equipment, unlike every other convention in the world right now. Does anybody have a laptop they'd be willing to let us put here and project our slides that way with? Also on a chair. Maybe would anyone like to stand here and be our laptop model?
Slide.
I have one. It's tiny, but I have one.
Well, all right. How about less than tiny?
How do you use it?
No, it's the size of the laptop.
Okay. Nobody brought their 17-inch MacBook with them.
I didn't bring my 15-inch.
It's just too heavy.
That's what she said.
Yeah, you're willing to sure. donate an hour of battery time?
Yeah.
We will give you something.
Okay,
we'll give you... Jared will donate a Parsley game to your cause, to the charity of your choice.
Why don't you donate one of your pretty books?
Because I need to make money to pay for your hotel room.
Start screensaver... Never.
Hello, come on in.
He's like disabled porn.
You might. Do you know Finnish? We've had a little Finnish language lesson.
Well, they can teach her. So
teach her how to say.
How do you say no?
No. And how do you say yes?
Have to shake your head, kind of like
yeah.
The no also has a head shake with it, like kind of like yeah. You can't believe somebody asked you that question, like nah.
So can you?
Yeah.
Okay. So we're getting started. And anything else is
going to start. Nah, just so it doesn't fall asleep. And
oh yeah, no, dude, that's a very responsibility. Yeah.
The only thing that falls asleep during our seminars are you people.
Yeah. So we were in Finland. We're not in Finland. We were in Denmark, and we met a group of Finns who had also come from very far to go to this convention. And the Danes are really kind of cold and like distant, remote, and
they're very serious,
kind of Aryan, and they would all play the villains in like any kind of World War II movie, so if you know what I mean. But the Finns are like they're a walking comedy troupe. It's like the driest, wryest, most hilarious comedy ever. And yeah. They're like they're filthy-minded drunks.
And they're all heavily armed and dangerous. Right.
And I think they all look like they're 40, but they're like 23. Also, did anyone know that there are more girl gamers in Finland than there are guy gamers?
By a lot.
By a lot. Like, as in, like, they, like, like if you talk to a male Finnish gamer, they're like, please come to my country and game with me.
We're totally
and we're
going.
And Jared and I are like, okay, we got to do the budget.
We did the math, and we're like, yes.
Yeah.
what the hell are we doing? That's not you. I'm talking to him.
Are you George? You're full screenish.
Right, where's the...
Hey, yo, can we offer a round of applause for the cool laptop and writing person?
Yeah, yeah, we're totally going to get a prize. I thought it was F, Command F. Okay.
Just kind of make it big.
I'm going to just kind of make it big.
You won the internet.
Oh, my God, now you broke it.
That didn't work. Whoa.
Do you want to view and do view as slides?
Oh, in my OS 10.4 or something ancient.
Slideshow. Bam!
Oh, there. Oh, Shift Command F. It is.
You need 8 fingers to use the mouse. Well, luckily, we have 10.
I have 10. Don't you? Does that not work? Oh, that's a play.
So if you have 11, we know somebody who wants to see you.
Okay. I know you can't. You all can't. Whoa, stopping. Stop. Okay. Okay, so we just have to use the arrow keys, I guess, sure?
That's fine.
Okay, so this is really more for our benefit. I know you guys can't see this, and we normally have a large multimedia presentation. If you can't see it, that's all right. We'll try to keep the jokes.
Bend it this way a bit?
Yeah. But that's really just so we can kind of stay on time, on point, and whatnot. If any of you have tickets, we'll take them and laugh at Gen Con about them. Gen Con
can put those tickets towards, you know, slide projectors.
If you
guys
see me, you get in.
What?
I don't know what your capacity. I can't let anybody else.
Okay, well, all right, watch that door. So.
That's why I'm here.
Everyone's quiet. Who here is designing a game? Who here wants to design games? Okay, rock and roll. Who here thinks that that their mind cannot be controlled by Jared and I? Who here thinks that you are strong-willed? And
well, we got him to speak Finnish, so...
Yeah. Nobody. I guess we've already blown our wad. Oh, wow, this is great, guys. Thank you. Nice to meet you. All right. We're totally going to run over in this panel.
Let's do it. Ticket, please. No tickets.
No tickets.
Awesome. All right. You know what I can get with these?
Nothing.
A room next year, maybe.
No, they threaten me every year. We won't give you a room unless you turn in your tickets. And, well, here we are, 9 years later. Okay. So my name is Luke.
And I'm Jared. And we are the Sons of Cryos.
Nobody gets that's obscure.
two people get it.
I design role-playing games, primarily tabletop role-playing games. I design Burning Wheel and House Guard, which some of you may have heard of. Jared has a bit of a deeper resume.
I have a bigger resume, but that's okay. So I designed a bunch of games, including Action Castle, which we'll be playing at 3 o'clock in E. And sir, laptop, that is for you.
Thank you. That's your free gift for participating in today's laptop.
So welcome. More gifts, more prizes later.
Okay, better ones. Can anyone see that? What's that from? Anyone?
Anybody? Game Design is mind control. That's us, Luke and Jared.
I knew that.
Yay!
Okay. What are games all about? Games are all about irrational behavior. We're going to get you using a game to do stuff you normally wouldn't do or normally wouldn't even think of doing. Things that seem even counterintuitive to what you would normally do. Games do this with a variety of things. Mechanisms.
Wait, what is a game? What's a game again? Hold on.
A game?
You're ahead of me.
Oh, well, you continue then. You go.
So take
the reins away.
So a game could be loosely described as a system which promotes irrational behavior in its users, which gets its users to do things they would not otherwise do in a normal setting.
Did I just say that?
So underneath that, a system is what, Jared?
System involves three things, which are on the slide. Mechanisms, feedback, and rewards. You guys all know this game, Operation. So the mechanism
is little tongues, and you're picking out little body parts from the patient. What's the feed? The feedback is pretty easy. So if you screw up, it lets you know right away. And the reward is the money you get for the different operations. And the harder the operation, the more money. Yay. So here's another game that promotes irrational behavior. It's a very old game.
Right.
One from the dawn of time. One that's, we estimate it has been done billions of times.
Billions of times.
Billions,
right?
Of times.
How many races have been run in the history of humankind, right? So this is a game. So we're going to run. I think we have to.
Well, that's why we have the slides, so we don't have to do this.
Oh, God, you're like killing the comedy, my friend.
I know.
Comedy will come later.
We have plenty of
time. So in a race, there's a starting line. You're running, right? So you have red guys ahead of blue guy going around the track. Who wins? Red guys ahead of blue guy?
Oh, yeah. Blue guy. Because the red guy takes a nap halfway through because he knew it was so far ahead.
Okay, well, that's Aesop's version.
Knowing what we know, in that the red is pulled ahead and that they're now moving at the same rate of speed and blue can't really overtake them, how can blue win?
Throw something at red.
Cheating.
Cheat! Right. So right.
He's already made it halfway there, and then, boop, he gets to the other side before red.
So right, without a... So if you say... Cross the finish line, mm-hmm. right? And this is the finish line. Well, I've crossed it, and now I've crossed it again, and I've crossed it again, right? But that's no fun. And you know, the other guy's like, well, I thought we had to run around the track. Well, nobody said. We're just running. It's a race. Cross the finish line, right? First across the finish line. But this is amazing process of design that, right, has happened over billions of iterations, where we have figured out as a world culture, right? Races are run in every culture. We figured out that it's more fun to run at full tilt across a predetermined course without smacking each other in the face, without tripping each other, without any kind of chicanery, right? Run at full tilt and then cross the finish line or reach the end goal, be the first to cross the finish line. That, those constraints, those utterly irrational, calorie-burning constraints, we have determined make the race more challenging and more fun for everyone, both the spectators and the participants. Totally irrational behavior. The rational thing to do is just to push the guy down or cross the sheet and cross the finish line or something like that. But the constraints create the interesting parts of the game.
And we call those constraints rules. And you can't have a race where you do push people down, but that's part of the rules. It's part of the agreed upon set of rules that you're using.
Okay, so let's play a game.
Where should I go?
Over here.
Okay.
Go good in the middle.
You're
gonna put a barrier between you and the audience?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
They look
okay.
Scary.
So we're gonna play a very, very simple game, and the rules are that the first person to shake my lovely partner's hand will win a shiny nickel.
Nice to meet you. That was easy.
What's your name?
Doug.
Doug, right. We've met Doug.
Yep.
How are you? Here's your nickel.
Sweet.
How do you feel?
I feel good.
You feel good? Okay. Simple. That nickel got a huge response out of the audience, huh? I think some of you might have even looked up from your iPhones.
Only for a second.
There you go. So, all right. So let's put that aside for a second. Let's put aside that little rules, risk, reward exercise and talk about a game that some of you might know. The original first-person shooter, Castle Wolfenstein.
Yes.
3D. 3D.
Castle Wolfenstein 3D because... I mean, it was totally 3D. That perspective, it's Caravaggio brought to life. That was for that guy right there. So Castle Wolfenstein. The mechanisms of Castle Wolfenstein. You have your monitor, your keyboard, and the keyboard you interface with the game. You have your arrow keys. You have your shift for your strafing. You have your space bar for fire.
Pretty simple.
Yeah, pretty simple. But that's your interface, and
you have everything on the screen that you're witnessing. You have a little first person view. You see your little hand holding something.
Right. Yeah. Your little status bar at the bottom. It's like even if you haven't played this game, you can imagine it's the most basic kind of first person shooter. It's a kind of first of its breed. It's a cool ass game.
And what else is there on screen besides your little hand and all your scores?
Right. What's the first thing you see on screen in a first-person shooter or Castle Wolfenstein, if you know
your
what we're talking
environment.
About?
Nazis.
Your environment, which
walls.
Is what?
Walls.
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 So what is a wall? What's a wall in Castle Wolfenstein?
Constraint.
Right. Right? It's constraint. It's feedback. The game is telling me something. Why can't I move this way? What is that? What the hell?
If you're just playing Castle Wolfenstein, you're walking along a little, what's his name, Bart, right? Or something like that? If he's walking along and all of a sudden you start walking in place and you're not going anywhere, you'd be like, oh, shit, I have to write to these guys. There's a bug.
Look down.
So what they do is they
don't look down yet.
What they put in is a wall. If they don't want you to move somewhere, they have to put some kind of visual metaphor to let you know in advance, before you even reach it, that something is up there, and you can kind of guess what it does because we have walls in reality, so it kind of makes sense.
That's right. I'm manipulating the arrow keys. I'm moving backwards. I'm not moving anymore. Right. So what? I'm a person playing this game. What happens now?
I turn around.
I look. Right. And now what happens?
Well, damn. Find somewhere else to go.
Find somewhere else to go. I'm learning. I'm a little. My little monkey brain is already getting the. You know, the game is already slipping its fingers into my brain. The game has already taught me expected behavior. It expects me now to look at to navigate around walls. Right. It's already constraining my behavior.
So walls don't actually exist.
Yeah, they're just pixels. So
what happens later on once you master that technique?
Right.
Go around walls, doors.
Oh. Until
you look for secret doors in the walls.
Exactly.
Right. It introduces secret doors. So what it does is it teaches you don't bump into walls. And then it says, hey, remember what that you know what we said about not bumping into walls? Now you gotta bump into walls.
So right. So I go from this, I go from this, this and I'm cool to it, like, it completely changes your behavior in the game once they introduce this new piece of feedback, this new interaction in the game. Your monkey brain kicks into overdrive because those are hidden things.
And all of a sudden it's like, whoa, something just happened.
We'll go get to that, though.
At random.
Okay, so...
But there's other types of feedback besides walls.
So what's... Yeah, someone else said it already. What do you got?
Nazis!
There they are. Right? So I'm walking down the hall, right? Hi. Well, this is a cool place. I guess it's Castle Wolfenstein's... Oh, hey, who's that guy?
Hark Leben!
Ow! Whoa! My face is red. Whoa! What's going on? Space!
Ah.
Whoa! Right, so that is, and actually, it is an immensely complex interaction which happens there. I see another, image on the screen.
Hello.
I get auditory.
Ah.
Achtung. Right, and then not only do I get more auditory, and I get something. I think that those pixels are a gun. Jesus, stop. I'm getting feedback on my status bar now. My little face is going, and the blood's running out of his nose. You get the bruised eye, or whatever, and that gets into your brain. And then as Jared so eloquently demonstrated, the entire interaction is topped off with a charity, with a reward, right? So, like, not only is it exciting to shoot a Nazi, which is just cool in its own right. Like, I would have been totally fine shooting him without any kind of reward.
That's true. That is its own reward. Virtue is its own reward.
But there's a whole other circumstance which happens. So I get bullets. All right, he pops up. I get bullets. You don't really get money in the game. So hello, there you are.
Yep.
So right. Get bullets, and I knock them down, and then so this now I've learned something. I've learned a new behavior in the game, and now I know every time I see him. Oh, I can strafe. Pop, pop, pop. Right. So
dead.
He gives me 6 bullets every time I shoot him, every time I shoot this dude, right? So how do I win the game?
Use less than 6 bullets.
Use less than 6 bullets. Actually, I could probably use 6 bullets every time because I start with some, I start with X ammo. So as long as I never exceed 6 bullets on each Nazi, win!
So that sounds like the best game ever.
Right? That's I'm going to do that thousands of times, right, for 10 levels. Right? That's great.
No.
So these are, right now we've described static parameters. We have walls that are never going to change, secret doors where the locations are never going to change, and an enemy that's never going to change, and a reward that's never going to change. Eventually, you're going to defeat this, at least in your own brain, right? You might not even want to finish the game because it's just boring. You do the same thing, there's no challenge, there's no dynamic set of parameters.
Who here plays tic-tac-toe?
Professionally.
No. Really? Like six of you play tic-tac-toe?
No, I'm waiting for the Olympics.
Who here knows how to solve tic-tac-toe?
Pretty much everybody.
Oh, yeah. More people that know how to solve it than play it.
Yeah. You guys are like, I know how to do this.
Right, that's telling, right? It's telling about the game. So
we're going to mix it up. We're going to change the parameters so that they're no longer static. We're going to add new and interesting things and random rewards and permutations of the game.
The mind control in Wolfenstein fails if you quit after level one, right? That's no fun for the game designers. So they need to find a way to keep you engaged, keep you interested. And they do this by introducing
random rewards and different enemies.
Right.
Harder enemies, enemies with different tactics, enemies with different weaknesses.
Random
guns.
Different guns,
and
right?
Of course, different weapons, different capabilities for the player too, right?
There's a little bit of excitement and reward in each of those. Like seeing a new enemy definitely has a quality of its
own
reward.
Using a new gun is great.
Using a new gun definitely has a quality of its own reward. But the thing that makes us crazy, it's like little monkey like bashing each other's heads in crazy, is the random rewards. Not knowing what we're going to get from this encounter. But knowing we might get something, but not knowing what it is.
So if you knew the baseline, the low-level Nazis would only give you clips, you would only shoot them if you needed ammo, right? And you'd ignore them the rest of the time. But suddenly, it becomes a slot machine. I could shoot that guy. It's going to cost me like 2 bullets because he's weak, or 3 bullets. He could give me an extra guy. He could give me points. He could give me health. He could give me more ammo. You don't know, so you're going to kill everything.
So right, and so now what we have is we start building a cycle of play in Wolfenstein where you are risking your resources, you're risking your ammunition and your health for random rewards. And these random rewards are giving you new capabilities, you know, could be weaponry, but the weapons in Wolfenstein aren't really random. They're either in a single location or they're in a drop, you know, which is set by the designer, but you don't really know that. We didn't know that back in, you know, 1991 or whatever. The feedback that the game is giving you, the new information it's giving you, is driving you to play the game in new and different ways. It's changing your behavior, but it's keeping you engaged in the game. And right, so this is a cycle. This is a currency cycle where you're spending your resources to further play the game. The game is giving you new resources, and you go all the way through that.
So let's talk about a new game with new resources.
If any of you are taking notes, currency cycle, that's like a legit game design term. So
most of these are legit.
Oh yeah. Okay. All right. So we talked about we theorized rather about how changing rewards can alter the amount of participation in the game. So let's put this to the test. So we'll play the game again. You guys know the rules. This time, whoever shakes Jared's hand will get a shiny quarter from I don't know. Okay. All right. So there you go.
Three people.
1999 quarter, sir. All yours.
Nice.
What's your name?
Eric,
how do you feel?
I feel ecstatic.
Really? Are you fucking with me, Eric? Ecstatic? That's a big emotion.
It's a big quarter.
So ecstasy. You feel ecstasy right
yes.
now. Oh, wow. Okay. Okay, well, we'll see how you feel later.
Eric's achievement. Three people go for the quarter. Two people really close, one person in the back.
So we increased our participation by 300% in that exercise. We increase our investment in that by 5. It's not really a very good payoff, right? So something's going wrong with our little game. Something's not quite hitting right.
We changed the reward, but we didn't really change the challenge.
We didn't change the challenge, you know, but we increased the reward by 5 times, dude. I mean, come on, it's a quarter.
Yeah.
He could play, like, a video game at a gas station in, like, Peoria, Illinois.
Yeah. that one lonely copy of Galaga.
Oh, God, I love that. I live for finding those.
Yeah.
Order, oh, my God.
What a sad life
not
I have.
$1.25?
Okay, so what are other small little rewards that we have become accustomed to receiving?
It's like, not even pennies, because they're worthless.
Right?
What a picture of a rose, or you could get a picture of a daffodil, and if you get all the flowers, you get a beehive. What?
is fun. Right?
Like, Zynga would say it's fun.
In fact, millions of people would say it's fun. Millions of people spending hundreds of millions, if not a billion dollars, would say this is fun.
Big company.
Right? And we're talking, the rewards they're getting are worth less than a nickel. Like, they're literally worth nothing. But people are investing in these things.
They're investing real money.
Is reversed. People are paying Zynga for 25 cents or 50 cents or whatever for these small little perks, these small little rewards. What the hell's going on there? How did they do that?
So the success of Farmville, one of them, isn't the fact that they're giving you cool things, because we've just established they're just pictures and they're really worth nothing and people are paying real money for them. The difference between Zynga's Farmville and other games is the rewards are coming at a constant and frenetic pace. They're small, but they're varied, so there's always something different, always something new. And the challenge, it's you just click. You just click, and every two, three clicks, you get something. You get a couple points added to your score. You get a rose or a daffodil or a goldfish. If you collect a whole bunch of things, hey, cool, it taps into that kind of obsessive-compulsive collective nature that we have, the reason why we play Magic the Gathering and the reason why we, you know, collect, you know, whatever your personal obsession is about collecting.
For me,
it was umbrellas for a while.
Facebook games, anyone cop to playing Facebook games? Has anyone ever played a Facebook game?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, has anyone ever invested financially in a Facebook game?
Just
you. Well, apparently
I'm the only one willing to admit it.
Yeah.
You guys, who's played Plants vs. Zombies?
Oh.
Yeah. Okay, who's finished the game and then kept going to do the achievements and try to unlock all of them?
Yep.
Yeah, like, why? I don't know. We do, right? I did. I was like on the subway every day going, I just need one more gem and I get that stupid achievement unlocked.
There's other achievements you can get, too.
Yeah, don't worry, sir. Apparently, the hundreds of millions of people who play games like you, they're out there. You're not alone. Okay, where are we? Okay.
Achievement unlocked, left the house. I do that every day almost.
Okay.
So, why?
Okay, yeah.
Why does this happen?
What's happening? What's going on in my brain,
Zynga, Gary? Are not game developers. They are drug dealers. I'm not being facetious. That is what all game designers ultimately are drug dealers.
I need you to come help me on my farm, man. That's why I need you to come help me on my farm.
Hey, man, I don't touch that stuff anymore. I'm off. Maybe you should go to a meeting with me. They have coffee.
There is your brain is the biggest drug dealer you know. Your brain should be arrested by the cops.
It will be soon.
The reason why the Zynga Madness works, the reason why games work in general, is because when we are rewarded, when something unexpected and pleasant happens to us, we get a shot of dopamine. And dopamine is an opioid. It's basically heroin in our brains. And now the shot that we get is commensurate with the risk, the challenge, the amount of the reward, whatever. So, like, these guys... It's not like Ed McMahon showed up with his giant check and was like, $1 million, publishers, you know. No, they're, like...
That would be ecstatic.
He said he felt good. He said, without unbidden, Doug said, sweet, right? Sweet's worth a nickel.
Static is worth a quarter.
over here, we show the fluidity of the English language, and ecstasy is worth a quarter.
Eric's brain is like Huggy Bear. And
so it's a very, it's not a simple reaction. It's not like, you can buy yourself that cup of latte at Starbucks every day for the rest of your life and get the same happiness you got the first time. You were like, wow, this is really good. This is what I want. Because our brains crave new information, crave new experiences.
Your brains want us to learn new things because learning new things enables you to survive, like, saber-tooth tiger attacks.
So the reward that our brain gives us, spikes early and tapers off slowly and then kind of rapidly. So where you're getting... This is why Wolfenstein with just one Nazi villain, you and a pistol and six bullets over and over again is not fun. Because it's fun the first time, and then without any new information or any new experience, the reward, the happiness, the thrill of it, which is a chemical reaction in your little monkey mechanic brain, is dropping off rather rapidly. And your brain's telling you to move the fuck on. Or find the guy with the chain gun.
He's interesting.
So this is a fun one.
Imperfect information.
Okay, so let's talk about other angles into that, the monkey brain then.
and other ways to motivate players. So now that you know that basically, as a game designer, they're drug dealers, and they talk about this shit. They in their like marketing meetings and their whatever, and they have like.
There's all sorts of interesting little acronyms.
Player investments.
Player investments, ROIs, and key factors, and
viral coefficients.
Oh, man. To be a game designer right now, you basically have to be an economics major with a marketing background. It's weird.
Yeah.
They want people who know Excel.
Minor in biology?
Sure, why not? That can't help.
So,
or can't hurt.
Okay, so imperfect information.
Freudian slip there.
So, many, many games... use imperfect information in order to keep the player guessing, in order to keep the player going. So imperfect information is basically when there's a section of the game that you just can't or don't know. The most classic game of imperfect information. Anyone?
Minesweeper.
Clue. No, the most classic. Minesweeper is like
widespread.
Battleship?
Poker.
Poker.
Right, poker. Poker is a deck of cards is an amazing engine of information, right? Oh my God, if you really want to blow your mind, if you really want to have to read an article like two or three times, read about information theory, real information theory. So a deck of cards contains all this information, when you lay it down there. In information theory, the more cards you draw, the less information there is in the deck.
Yeah,
you're all nodding. But the more knowledge you have, though, right? The more you know about the deck, the less information there is in it. Wow, I love it. Anyway, so right, poker. You don't know what your opponent has in his hand, you don't know what's in the deck.
You make guesses, but you based can make, on what you have and what you've seen.
Right. The elegance of poker is that you can begin to make educated guesses. The more experienced player you are, the more you're paying attention, the more information you can make an educated guess at.
Games like Magic the Gathering, one of the key abilities in Magic the Gathering is to take imperfect information and make it perfect, to basically minimize randomness, minimize the chance of drawing a card you don't want. And there's tons of cards in that game that are devoted to that purpose.
So let's talk about a more modern game that uses imperfect information, StarCraft. So what's the imperfect information in StarCraft?
What your opponent's building.
What your opponent's building, but they have a name for it in StarCraft.
Log of War.
Log of War, right? So for those of you who don't play StarCraft, StarCraft blacks out the screen outside of your kind of little unit view radius. This is a pretty commonplace mechanic at this point. StarCraft didn't invent it. They stole it from Doom 2.
That's awesome.
But anyway, and the more... You can't see what your opponent's doing, right? And that's a giant weakness, because StarCraft is a game. The StarCraft's design is to be move, counter move. So if you cannot see what the move that's coming, you can't counter it. So the fog of war in StarCraft, the imperfect information is a handicap. It's a huge handicap, and you have to dispel it. So what behavior do you have to undertake in these games to gain more information?
Scout. Risk.
Right? And yeah, you have to risk units.
Exactly.
Short-term
risk,
time.
Long-term reward.
And you have to scout out. You have to send, what do you send? Who sends what?
Drones,
peons, your
something
first marine.
Expendable,
right?
Just in case.
Right. And
it's also quick. It's something immediate. You can immediately send out a drone.
So then, and you begin dispelling the imperfect information and getting... better information, but StarCraft is also very elegant. If you remember, in the very first version of Warcraft, you would dispel the fog of war, and that was it, right? It was you. Then you could see the map. But they learned that wasn't enough. That basically allowed for cataclysm, for basically eight wizards just all going blizzard, 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 and anything that moved. God, I hated playing that game. So they added another layer to the fog of war where you explore it and then it grays out. So you know the terrain, you know the buildings that are there, the static things, but then all the kind of moment-to-moment stuff you can't see unless you have a live viewer right there.
And what happens if you don't know what happens to with the enemy?
Right. Siege tank rush. Right. If you don't know what's going on, if you're not paying attention, if you're not exploring, you're just, opening yourself up for abuse.
Or like me building a symmetrical base. I have to move that. I put it in the wrong place. I have to destroy it and rebuild it.
Let me tell you, Jared's very good at StarCraft.
I like the Protoss because they're yellow.
Okay.
It's true. They're like, they look cool. I'm going
to
play them.
So imperfect information, right? All games have to have imperfect information to function?
No.
No. Correct. What is the ultimate game? It is a game of perfect information?
Chess.
Correct. The chess is a little more classic. So in chess, it is possible to know all of the moves available to you and your opponent at any one time. Right? So all the information is there. The only thing you don't know is what move your opponent's going to make. Now, that's very, very difficult. In fact, we have, you know, entire, machines dedicated to figuring out this logic. There's another seat up here, and there's a seat up here, if you guys want to sit.
Okay.
Since we're playing musical chairs back there.
chairs right in the front row. This is not the act where we do the watermelon and the hammer. That's next. I am the Gallagher of role-playing.
Gallagher. Yes, Jared is the Gallagher of role-playing. So chess is a game of perfect information. So chess has obviously managed to maintain its fascination for quite a long time, maintain its allure. And it is so complex. There are so many options. There's so much information that it is almost impossible to make a perfect decision, despite having all the information at your disposal.
So you make your best guess, right? You choose your move based on what you think the opponent's going to do and what you think how you think the game's going to progress in the future.
Right.
You can't predict what's going to happen, but you can make an educated guess.
Right.
That's what chess is about.
Yeah, making educated guesses and making choices. Another game of perfect information is it one. Anyone play Diplomacy? Yeah. Anyone actually ruin a friendship with Diplomacy? Well, it's one. That's pretty good. If you want to design games, if you're interested in game design, if you want to kind of have an insight into games, play Diplomacy. Try to play it live, too. It's a much more visceral experience. Don't have any emotions about it. Just play the game. But that's the thing.
That never happened.
That's where. So Diplomacy is a game of its great powers Europe, and you're like you can see all the pieces on the board. You can know every move possible in Diplomacy. You just don't know what your opponent's going to do. It's just like chess. But there's multiple players, and you're allowed to conspire, and you're in fact encouraged to conspire with one another. And the complexity of maneuver in Diplomacy is sublime. It's an amazing game. But despite the ability to know everything, you just can't. You can never make the perfect decision in that game. It's so elegant and so wonderful. If you haven't played it, absolutely play it. And yeah, I try to just go in with an open mind and not want to kill your friends.
So games, we've decided that games can have imperfect or perfect information. They can have random rewards or static rewards. And all games need to be about choices, right? Like, you have to be able to make a meaningful decision or it's not a game.
So a game has to have interaction, feedback, currency cycle, and some form of information. Right? Must, right? Otherwise it's not a game?
No.
No.
So meaningful decisions. So what are the meaningful decisions in Candyland?
None.
What color are you?
Draw a card.
Meaningful decision.
Meaningful decision is a decision that the player makes that can affect the outcome of the game.
Make the bridge.
Who goes first?
Yeah. Hey, I think it's probably in the rules.
That's the youngest player.
Youngest player goes first. So there are no meaningful decisions in Candyland. Like the player cannot make a choice in the game that affects the outcome of the game. The player can activate the mechanisms of the game.
It's basically a pure procedural game.
Right. Why do you play Candyland? What's going on in Candyland?
It's the board. Not much going on. Colors, you draw a card, move on to the next space.
Lord Legrush is trying to take over.
So what are you doing there? You're talking, you're making up a story. It's interesting. So yeah, why do we, who plays Candyland?
Children.
Right? Nobody here does, right? Except maybe with their kids.
Very young children, right?
There's no competitive Candyland League down in Route B12.
Next year,
couple big guys, beards like. I gotta move two red spaces.
So
we get it.
You're
gonna bet on the game.
Candyland, is a purely procedural exercise, but there's something else going on beneath the surface of Candyland. It's called an emergent property or emergent behavior, where the rules of Candyland tell you who goes first, what turns to take, what happens when you land on what square, and how the game ends. Right? What Candyland doesn't tell you is why you play the game, why children play this game, and why children should play this game. And children play this game because it teaches them to play games. Right? It teaches kids how to take turns, how to interact with pieces on the board, how to move pieces, how to pull cards, what the card means, all that stuff. Teaches kids, you know, who goes first, who goes last, how to win, how to lose.
It teaches kids that games have constraints and that you should follow them, and if you do, you'll have fun.
Right. At that level, for the, you know, that level of development for kids, you know, what 4 or 5 years old for Candyland, the kind of, you know, for most kids, like the tactical and strategic decisions of gameplay aren't that interesting. In fact, might even be upsetting. It's not that they might begin to intuit that stuff at that point, but that comes a couple of years later, really. So gameplay is a different exercise for young kids. It's an exercise of socialization and learning. Where for us, it's almost the, like, gameplay is something else. Gameplay is another kind of expanded instinct.
So Monopoly. Play games. Monopoly teaches you how to not play games.
Yeah. So, okay. So, yeah, this game teaches you to ignore the rules. So, Jared, go
for
it.
There's a space. What's that space? Next slide.
Free parking.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Free parking. So, what happens?
Nothing.
Wait, whoa, there's a rule. Let's figure out what the rule is.
Nothing happens.
Somebody said something else, though.
Yeah. You take the fee money.
Oh, okay.
All taxes.
You take all taxes in the center of the board when you're free parking. Who does that? Who has fun playing Monopoly? Who knows the real rule? Okay. What happens?
Nothing.
Right.
Monopoly.
You don't have to pay anybody anything.
It's just the one space on the board where nothing happens.
Right. It's free parking, and it's hilarious. Monopoly is this. There's this cult of house ruling with Monopoly for free parking. I do it too, and I. Monopoly. And it took me, I basically had to start designing games to figure out why I hated Monopoly. And it's not because I'm a socialist or anything. It's because we were ruining the game. We're introducing an inflationary economy into the game, which is causing the game, because we're having, like, this pity party on free parking, like, oh, here, poor person, or you get all this money, and then, oh, here, rich person, now you get all this money, and we're introducing all these resources into the game never intended to have, and therefore the game is getting drawn out far beyond its intended play cycle, and we all hate each other after, like, 4 hours of, you know, Baltic Avenue hotels.
And it's weird, because the board is kind of telling you, well, this, something happens when you land on this space, something happens when you land on this space. Every single space on the board, and there's a lot of spaces, but that one space, it seems weird to us that nothing would happen. So we kind of have invented, like, as a culture in America, we've invented this mythological space. Free parking means you get all the money in the center of the table. Where's the rule that you put all the money in the center of the table? I don't know where that rule is either. We do that too.
So that's an emergent property. Weird. That actually, it seems like it's fun, it seems like it's great, but if you really examine it, it probably makes, that probably detracts from the gameplay experience.
Definitely it affects the outcome.
But it feels really good when you get all the money, right? Does it feel really good 4 hours
that's
later
probably,
when you're still playing?
That's that immediate satisfaction in exchange for a long-term depression.
Okay. All right. So, so emergent properties are a complex and nuanced procedure, and you often can't design for them, right? Like the guys...
But they're called emergent.
Yeah, you know, the Candyland stuff, maybe they might have designed for that. The Monopoly thing, definitely not. And this next game, they certainly did not design for this emergent property. Take it away, Jared.
So...
Oh, wait, yeah. Oh, it's Clue.
It's Clue.
Yeah, it's Clue. Yeah. Are you new to this? Okay.
Yeah. All right. So, I got Clue. So you guys have all played Clue, right?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. What's your favorite piece to play? Does anybody have a favorite color of a favorite piece? What's yours?
Mr. Plum.
Yeah, Professor Plum. I like Colonel Mustard, too.
Colonel Mustard.
Colonel Mustard. How about, who likes Miss Scarlet? Mrs. Peacock. You guys know all the characters, right?
There's no characters in this game.
They're different color. That's them. A couple of them are missing, but the weapons have more personality than the characters. They're pawns. They're all pawns. They have different colors, but whatever.
Who murders their opponents in Clue? Who actually takes the weapons and is like little
rope? Yes.
Only. Three, four.
The game.
That's the classic one. Yeah. So the game doesn't say talk in an English accent if you're playing Professor Plum. Professor Plum. How do you talk when you are Professor Plum?
I'm moving this way.
Why? I do it too. I talk like Foghorn Leghorn when I'm the Colonel.
I don't. The game doesn't tell me to do that. I don't get any special. Like Professor Plum isn't like doesn't get a +2 finding secret doors in the library, right? And the game doesn't say, hey, if you talk in a funny voice, you get an extra card at the end of the game to find out who killed Mr. Body. Why do we do this? Because we're crazy? Maybe. The game doesn't reward the behavior either. The game doesn't. You don't get extra points or extra cards or anything in the game for
just,
that behavior.
We just do it, and it makes the game better. And this is where games get really weird, and this is why Gen Con exists, is because of games like Clue.
Believe it or not.
So, D&D. Who's played D&D? The first role-playing game, right?
Rockin'.
There's no role-playing in D&D. There's no rule about talking in funny voices. There's no rule about creating cool stories. There's no rule about any kind of personality or characterization in D&D other than pick your race, pick your class, pick your alignment, pick what type of weapon you're going to kill orcs with, and pick what spells you have if you're a wizard and you roll lucky. Because I think a first level cleric doesn't actually get spells, which is really fair. But not.
He gets a mace and chainmail, though.
That's true, but a mace is just as good as a sword.
D6 damage.
Oh, right. Mm.
Flasks of oil.
Don't I get a bonus against undead or something?
No. What edition are you playing?
I'm hating myself.
So, there's no role playing in Dungeons and Dragons, but it became the role playing game, right? It's the father of everything. So why? What happened in between Gary and Dave sitting down at the table going, okay, I'm moving my piece 2 squares and there's a kobold, you need a THACO of 13 or a roll or stroke my beard. Done. Okay, we killed him. Eventually, one of the guys went, you kobold, what is your name? And Gary was like, I didn't write that down. Let me check my notes. And then they started role-playing. So why?
We have some theories.
So, Paladin walks into a room.
Oh, God. That sounds like a joke.
Or actually, I'm sorry, a lawful fighter. Excuse me.
Yes.
Let's
lawful fighting man.
A lawful fighting man walks into a room. The room is full of goblin babies. This happened. This really, in a game, really happened. Right? So what did the lawful fighting man do to the evil babies? Okay. He might have killed him.
Or he walked away.
Set him on fire. What is the player doing right there? What is going on? There's a lightning storm in the player's brain at this point.
The player goes,
What did you say?
What's the ethical choice?
Right. There you go. The player cannot help it. We are human beings. We are ethical and moral creatures, no matter how sociopathic we are in our gameplay. And that saying that you obey laws, saying that there is evil in front of you, saying that evil are you know, or it's potential evil in the form of children, and setting that in front of pretty much nearly anyone, is going to trigger an ethical or moral decision in that person. And that breeds identification, right? You do enough of that, like, some of you are thinking, like, I would do this. Yeah, I would. You know, I would kill them because they're evil babies. They're going to grow up and be, you know, evil goblins. I would kill them. And some of you are thinking, you know, no, we would. You know, I would take one. And some of you are thinking, I would take one and raise it as my own. And some of us are like, that is not lawful.
I could raise it to be lawful.
Yeah, maybe.
It's also nature versus nurture. It's not just lawful, right? Even picking your race in your class. Like, okay, you're a fighter. You enter the dungeon. How are you behaving as a character in this world? You're a fighter.
Like, boldly going forward.
Right. You have a sword and a shield and some armor, and you're like, that's enough, follow me. Whatever, you know, whatever your alignment. Either you're like, we shall right the wrongs and save the innocents, or you're like, we shall slaughter everybody. It's going to be awesome. So if you're the thief, what are you doing? Because you're rewarded, right? So you don't have to do that. You don't have to skulk. You can just say, I backstab for 3 points extra damage or whatever. You don't have to, like, roleplay that I'm skulking in the shadows and I'm speaking like this and I'm kind of, you know, I'm eyeing my companion's purses. That's cool that you're doing that, but it doesn't do anything in the game. But all these, like, little expectations, you're like, well, how, okay, if I'm playing a thief, that's kind of a loaded term, right? You're not playing a pickpocket, you're not playing a burglar, you're not playing a rogue like you do now, you're playing a thief. That means you take your companion's purses as they're, like, counting loot.
Right. avatar identification is this supremely powerful force, and we do it in Clue, we do it in role-playing games, and it's, the more...
Might even do it in chess.
Maybe.
It makes horsey noises when they're playing.
Why?
Gary Kasparov does.
So,
he doesn't.
So, the more you can kind of get the player's vision through the eyes of the piece, whatever the piece may be, the more identification you can engender. I mean, how many of you recount tales of your Xbox game last night by saying, oh, and then the pixelated guy, you know, went into a room and shot some stormtroopers? How many of you say, oh, and then I burst into the room, and I shot these stormtroopers, and I got an extra life?
The people sitting next to us when we're having lunch at Gen Con who aren't into what we do must think we're all crazed murderers. So then we burst into the cultist temple, and, you know, of course, I took up my flamethrower, and I killed them all. And this woman, you know, sitting next to you going...
Flamethrowers are against the law.
Killing those cultists.
Okay. All right. So
scary.
We're running short on time, so this last slide is actually really important to me, and I want to run through it because I feel like it ties a bunch of this stuff together.
It's like the last piece of the role playing puzzle.
So we have three games up here in the slides. One of them is Memoir 44. Have any of you heard of this? It's by Days of Wonder, designed by Richard Bork. So for those of you who haven't heard of it, Memoir 44 is a board game that combines two things which I never thought could or should be combined. I think you'll agree with me: World War II and fun. If you haven't played it, again, it's a brilliant game. It's elegant. It's tactical. You play a full game in about 90 minutes. The full game is you play allies, and then you switch and you play axis or whatever, vice versa. Then GURPS.
You guys know them, GURPS.
GURPS,
right?
World War II. GURPS is a venerable generic role playing system, and they have setting books for every possible imagined or unimagined setting, historical or otherwise. One of them is GURPS World War II. And then the third game that's on the slide is a game called The Gray Ranks, which is a tiny little role playing game about playing Polish resistance fighters' children in the Warsaw Uprising in 1944. Have any of you heard of The Gray Ranks? Wow, you more have heard of Gray Ranks than Memoir 44. It shows where I am. So, when you're playing Axis and Allies or you're playing World War II, I want you. We're gonna have a little honest moment. Have any of you, you know, been winning as the Axis, right? And had your tanks at Paris and said, "No, I can't do this."
Yeah.
Right? Now, have any of you made German, bad German accents and like rolling, crushy tank noises as you've ridden victorious into Paris? Okay. I'm going to ask this, and this makes me a little nervous. Nazis, right? They're not cool.
No, Nazis,
right? Nazis are not cool. Right? Okay.
They dress really cool.
Shut the fuck up. Sorry. He needed to hear that, though. So, right. Have any of you taken that last piece in Risk and said, "No, Commandant Fernand, he needs to go home to his love. He will not fight. He cannot. He cannot stand. He will go through Chile and up through Latin America, whatever it takes to get home to Spain." But, right? No, we don't. The game does not. It's like the level of identification at that point, at that zoom out in these games, they're not making moral ethical decisions about that. And we're making horrible decisions. We're committing slaughter. Okay. So in a role-playing game like GURPS, it's a very standard, traditional role-playing game. You have you're going to play heroes, you're going to play guys with Tommy guns and have like personality quirks, and you're going to kick down doors.
My guy, he always makes sure he has an unlit cigarette behind his ear to smoke after he kills a Nazi.
Right.
Okay.
We're going to kill Nazis, and we're going to have fun doing it. Right? Are we really going to think about the atrocities going on behind all this? Are we really going to think about that we're committing war crimes too? No, even though we've stepped down into a level of identification where we can see through the characters' eyes.
And they do have names, and they do have families, they do have backgrounds, but...
The frame in the game just isn't that
intimate or, you know, the ethical and moral decisions in the game are very blocky, very easy.
Guys, black and white.
Yeah, guys in you know, basically, GURPS is Inglourious Basterds, like, you know, at its best, it's Inglourious Basterds.
Great Ranks, however, not so much. So, it's as different as memoir as can be.
So in Great Ranks, you can't win. You cannot win the war. You cannot win the battle.
You're 13-year-olds and you have a gun that's probably not working and your sister's been taken prisoner.
Right, you're doomed in this game, and you know it, to start. And the gameplay is what basically how you comport yourself in these moments. Basically, what decisions do you make? What's more important to you? Which friends are more important to you? Which family is more important to you? You know, it's not about... There's no kicking in the door and gunning down Nazis and, you know, and then lighting a cigarette and, you know, throwing it down.
It's about finding an 8-year-old kid in a Nazi uniform, asleep at his post, and you have a knife. Do you walk by, or what do you do? And that's kind of horrible decision.
So basically, up here, we have kind of these high-level strategic tactical decisions. In the middle, we have, you know, kind of characterful, comic book-y level decisions. I mean, that's doing a disservice to comic books, really. But just like these kind of very simple, black-and-white moral decisions. But we also have a great degree of strategic resources, some tactical resources, how many bullets we have, how many grenades we have, like lots and lots of weapons fetishism in the game. And then in the final one, we have none of that. We only have moral and ethical decisions.
Are there any gun types in Great Ranks?
I doubt it. I can't remember. So you only have a game of moral and ethical decisions. Now, they all have the same content. You're doing the same thing. You're fighting Nazis in all of the games.
Even the same time and place.
Same, yeah. You can
1944 Poland. It's the same exact setting,
yeah.
But three incredibly different ways to deal with the issue.
All right. So we are going to... We are going to skip to the end. We're going to skip our summation.
You just
we're
going to
play
over.
One more game. All right.
You guys familiar with this game? Great game.
Okay. There's no speed component to this game.
Yeah, this game you can do from your chair. Honest.
Yeah. Okay.
So here are the rules of the dollar auction. How much would you spend to win a dollar?
Okay. So the rules of the dollar auction. Bidding increments. You can bid for this dollar. You can buy this dollar for me for 10 cents. 10 cents, right? You can hold on. You want to know the rules. You can outbid the previous bidder and buy, you know, a 10 cent increment. So if somebody bids 10 cents, you can bid 20 cents and buy the dollar for 20 cents. Going once, going twice, going three times, sold, you make 80 cents, right? But the second player, the person behind you has to pay and gets nothing. Okay?
So the top two bids have to pay, but only the high bidder gets the dollar.
Okay.
Got it?
All right. So do I hear 10 cents for this?
10 cents.
All right, 10 cents.
20 cents.
20 cents to Doug.
30 cents. Back with your hand raised in the rainbow shirt.
Okay. Do I hear 40 cents?
40 cents. 40 cents.
50 cents.
50 cents.
50 cents.
50 cents.
60 cents.
60 cents.
70
cents.
80 cents.
80
cents.
90. 90 cents?
A dollar.
Dollar. $1.
Dollar. Oh, you think you broke the game. Dollar 10.
Dollar 10.
Dollar 10.
Dollar 20.
Dollar 20. Dollar 30.
Dollar 30?
You're just going to keep your... betting against yourself now? Dollar 30.
Dollar...
I'm betting against myself.
You're $1.20
20
right now.
No, you're dollar 20. Yeah, do we hear dollar 30?
Dollar 30.
Dollar 30.
Dollar 30.
Dollar
40. Dollar 40. Dollar 50. $1.50. Are you guys just going
to
go back and forth? $1.50. $1.60.
You
both
will.
Yeah. You both have to pay.
$1.60. $1.70. $1.70. Is this going to go on forever and we get to retire?
I don't know. This might be our moment.
Finally, it happened. $1.80. $1.90. $1.90 in the plaid. $2. $2 rainbow.
Making money on stubborn.
$2.10. $2.10. $2.10. Going once, twice. $2 to rainbow in the back, and $1.90 from the gentleman in the plaid shirt.
I thought it was two for me. That's why I stopped it.
Nope. It was two, and we were. Yeah, we were asking for $2.10. Nobody bid $2.10.
So $2.90 in two. Come on, gentlemen.
All right,
collect your prizes.
So how do you feel?
I feel good. Can you bring 100?
No. You're paying.
One.
All right, there you go, sir. There's your dollar.
I owe him a dime.
We have change.
So who here, when we walked into the room, we said, you're going to pay. Here you go, sir. Here's your change. But how do you feel?
In control.
In control. Who here, we walked in and said, you know what? You're going to give me, I'm going to give you $1 and you're going to give me $2. And I just said that to you. Right? None of you would have done that. Some of you might have been, oh, well, all right, let me see what he's going to do, and I would have laughed at you. But you change the parameters of the game, you introduce rewards and unknown reward and imperfect information, and suddenly the game becomes a lot more interesting. Thank you all for coming.
And where are Jared and Luke?
Booth 311. Booth comes to booth 311. Also, Jared's panel is right now.
In number E.
Action Castle, if you want to see how feedback works, he will show you
the
hardcore.
Most fun you will have in Gen Con.
Yeah, please do. Yeah.